Mr. Gibson, reel two. You started work at Binns. How much was it? Do you recall your first wage?
7 and 6 pence per week.
And what hours did you have to work to get that?
From 8 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock, and then on Saturday morning, 8 o'clock till 12:30. The other men finished at 12, but I had to sweep away the shavings and the sawdust.
With your, you know, intelligence and your life of being pride that in a grammar school, a senior school, it must have been pretty hard for you.
Yes, well, wasn't too bad because we had the Sunderland Technical College and the Junior Technical College, and I went to night school 3 and 4 nights a week because although I was in that job, I had aspirations. My great aspiration was to be a teacher. And in those days, there were no grants. You couldn't go to college on a grant. You had to pay. The only way you could do it was by, I hoped, by being a woodwork teacher. And I was prepared to be a woodwork teacher. And hence, I went to the technical college at night time and studied all things to do with woodwork. Technical drawing, isometric projections and things like that.
Was this City and Guilds?
Yes, City and Guilds, yes.
Which is a very high standard skill.
Yeah. Well, later on I was doing 4 nights a week by 1938. And we had to do French, 2 Englishes, physics and maths, of course. I got the first part and then, of course, the war broke out. I've still got my certificate to it.
So you started work at the age of 15 in the factory, and presumably you handed your wage over to your mother.
Yes, 7 and 6 pence. I got 1 and 6 pence. She got 6 shillings.
But a very important addition to the house.
Oh yes, that made a terrific difference.
Finding yourself working out would be pretty hard at first. Did you have to put up with the tricks that the senior workers, the older workers played on you?
First of all, when I put on an overall for the first time, I didn't like meeting up with my school pals because I'd left school. They were still at school in their uniform, and I was in an overall when the rest of them were going into offices and things like that. So it was rather a come down that. But what was the original question?
As I said, usually when youngsters started to work with older people.
Oh yes, in a factory.
It was kind of initiation.
That's right. You were sent up for a wire netting oil can or to go to the office and get the long stand, you know, that's right. But after a year stoking the boiler, I came up onto the machines, you know, on the mortising machine. Then I advanced to the planing machine, then onto the cross-cut saw, and then, you know.
And these would be see an advance in your pay, presumably?
Oh, yes.
As you qualified as those.
I think I was getting about 19 shillings in when I was 19 years old.
Were they good employers?
I don't think so. No, they were all right. But, you see, once I got started in the factory, I realised that if I wanted to be a woodwork teacher, I should be upstairs in the cabinet making. And for all I applied to them, no, they wouldn't let me change over. And it could have been done quite easily.
What were working conditions like? I know obviously you were working in dust and so, but were there the there wouldn't be the safeguards that they are today for people working in those conditions?
No, well, first of all, there was the dust. And then after about 2 years, they had a system which drew the dust from all the machines. But prior to that, the dust just pervaded the whole factory, especially from the sandpapering machine where my father worked. I don't know how he survived to be 84, because he was breathing mahogany dust, oak dust all day long.
Did they have any thing like a canteen? And
no canteen, no. As an apprentice, when it came to 10 to 12, I had to dash upstairs, put the one kettle on, beat the other apprentices from the joiner shop, put the kettle on, and then get the men's cans and mash their tea for them.
That was before you got yours?
Before I got mine, yes.
And you would take your food from home? And
well, I never stayed.
Well, it was close to you, was it?
Well, it was about a couple of miles, but my father and I were good walkers. We walked to work, and then we took us quarter of an hour to walk back home, quick lunch, quarter of an hour to walk back. It was very strict. You clocked on, and you weren't allowed to be 3 minutes late, or you would lose half an hour's pay.
And they had nothing like a medical insurance system for you?
Nothing like that, no.
None of that backup?
No.
So you would work for them until, as you say, the army came, and you had to.
Yes, right. Yes.
The 30s were obviously tough years in themselves, as you've suggested. But were there? Did you see increasing signs that there were problems coming again?
Yes, I used to read the newspapers about, you know, what was happening in Germany on the continent and Hitler's shenanigans. And I remember going to the films one night to a cinema and seeing a little film called The Gap. Now, I think it was a propaganda film. And it was more or less a city, maybe London. And they had a defence around London, but there was one gap. They didn't have enough places to fill it. And the bombers came in, you see. And then it appealed to people to join up. So although I was doing four nights a week at the technical college, I joined the territorials. So I used to do four nights at the week and still managed to go to the territorials and put enough drills in and still keep up with the choir at Bishop Emmanuel Church. So I was kept busy.
And that was the reason why you joined the territorials? It wasn't because friends went or pals encouraged you to go?
Well, I mean, we were all in the same mind, our friends. About six apprentices from the same place, we joined up together. Plus about six out of the choir.
What did your parents think of that? I mean, your mother had lost family, hadn't she, in the
war? Yes, she'd lost her eldest brother had been killed in the First World War. My Uncle Fred had been a prisoner with the Germans. He came back with horrid stories.
And how did she feel that you were putting a uniform on?
Well, she didn't like it at all. She'd worked in munitions during the First World War, and she was deaf because of the noise.
Yeah, what year was it that you joined the territorials?
Spring of 1939.
And by then there were a lot of signs that, you know, war may be imminent.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Had that thought, you know, struck you?
Yes,
you
I was all prepared for it, yes. We knew it was coming. And we went to camp.
Can we, just before you go into camp, what was the process of actually joining? You've decided to go and you go to the drill hall, or where was the drill hall?
Oddly enough, it was next door to our factory. We joined up next door to our factory. In fact, if you'd bored a hole through, you could have gone through into the drill hall from our factory, from where I worked.
So what was the process of joining?
A chap, I think it was a colonel, came to the factory gates and said if we would like to join, would we go to the drill hall that night? So a few of us who were apprentices agreed to go around. We joined up.
And did you have to sign anything?
Yes, we were sworn in, you know. We had a promise to serve king and country, etc.
What was the unit that you were joining?
Well, it was going to be the 2nd 74th. The 74th Regiment was from South Shields. And the a nucleus of officers and NCOs were coming from there to start a second 74th from the men around Sunderland. Later, the name was changed to the 125 Field Regiment.
So, first of all, it was the 2nd 74th
Field Regiment?
Royal Artillery.
Yes.
And that was the, well, obviously it was the particular unit that you knew you were joining, wanted to join.
Yes.
There's no question of Durham Light Infantry and any other local regiment being involved.
About five officers and five NCOs came from that Shield Regiment to start us off.
What was the drill hall like?
Oh, it wasn't good. Drill hall was called the Green. It was actually on the Green, which was the Green, the village Green of Bishop Weymouth Church. So the church where I was in the choir, the factory where I worked, and where I joined up were all within about 80 yards. And where I went to night school was about 40 yards round the corner at the Technical College. So in that small area was my whole life.
It's quite amazing.
From morning till night.
And the drill hall itself, what did it look like? How can you describe it to me?
Well, it looked like a big yard with with walls round. I'd gone there quite often because, as I say, as I came out of church on a Sunday morning, sometimes I could hear the band. And the police band would be practicing in the drill hall, and I used to go and listen.
Was there any weapons, large guns in the hall as part of your training?
No.
These were the early days, as you say, the early just setting days. Up at the second
It 74. Was the days when you used broom shanks for practicing.
How long had you to wait to get your uniform?
Several months, yes.
So you're basically still doing everything in your civvies?
Those of us who could, we used to go to the Army and Navy stores and buy our own tunics.
Did that lead to any confusion? Was there a mixture of tunics?
No. The tunics were still the old style, was in before the battle dress, you see. The battle dress came later.
This would be the First World War type of
First World War tunics, yes.
With putties?
Oh, yes, we had terrible things, those putties.
They must have been, must have been difficult to put them on and keep
them
on.
Well, yes, because you had to end up with the putty having the V shape on the outside exactly right. So you had to try a few times before you ended up that way. In fact, you could make a mark on your leg where you start, because they were long, they were about a yard long. So we were really pleased when the putty stopped and they gave us gaiters.
I should think that one of the problems is if you pulled them too tight, they would affect your circulation. Or too slack and they would come off.
I don't think that ever entered our heads.
And you get the ammunition boots.
How
did you take to those?
I'd worn boots nearly all my life, you see. And then when they said you're going on route marches, well, my dad and I had walked to work and dashed backwards and forwards. And on a Monday, I used to finish work at 5 o'clock, dash home, have some, because at 6 o'clock I was back in the college for physics. So I was walking backwards miles every day. And then miles with Jackie Newton and our Natural History Society, we'd walk miles into the country. Well, when they said a route march, when it was over, I said, well, was that it?
So your first training then would be what, basic infantry drill? Is that kind of training that you got?
Yes, but you see, I volunteered to be a signaller. And I was told that you had to learn the Morse code. And some men took ages to learn the Morse code. I learnt it in one night. Because as I went home from the drill hall, all the shops on my way home, Gallons, Kemp's, Butchers, Dodds, Pork Butchers, as I was going, I was changing it into Morse code. Did, 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 you see? So by the time I went back to the second drill, I knew the Morse code.
And did you start your signalling training immediately then, if that's the case?
Yes, yes. One of the sergeants who had come from Shields, he was a signal sergeant. And he... But because I learnt the Morse code straight away, he gave me a group. And I became an instructor practically on my third drill.
And still in your civilian clothes at this point?
Yes,
in time.
Still in civilian clothes.
And what was the training that a signaller got in those days?
Well, apart from this man teaching us, I was sent on a course to Darlington for a month to the Royals, the Signals Regiment. They weren't artillery signals, but at least they knew about practicing sending messages with Morse code and by telephone and by flag. So we did a month of that. And when I came back, I had to pass my knowledge on to the other lads.
The equipment that you had, was it particularly sophisticated? I'm thinking in terms of the telephone, for example.
Oh, the Don 3 telephones. They were First World War things, yes.
And they lay out with cables, obviously, to the
various... Yes.
And was part of your training repairing the cables?
That's right, yes. That's why... if you scraped the Don 3 wire, it was a linen, inside of that was rubber, and inside the rubber there were strands of steel and strands of copper. And I can hear that Sergeant Major in Darlington saying, "Steel for strength and copper for conduction," you see. And later on, as it says in that book, I made my guitar strings using Japanese telephone wire because of that knowledge.
How long did it take, if you can answer this, how long did it take to become proficient as a signaller? Obviously, it would depend upon the quality of the person. But.
Yes. Well, in my case, it didn't take very long, because a few months later, in end of January, I was sent to the School of Signals in Kattrick for a month. It was freezing in Kattrick. What a bare place Kattrick was in those days. And I was a Lance Bombardier among sergeants and officers. And at the end of that course, I was given a piece of paper on which they said, "Well done, youngster," because I got 99% for buzzer, 98% for lamp, and 90-something. I'd come out about top of the thing, you see, because I was so interested in it.
Of the various implements that you learnt, semaphore, the Aldus lamp, buzzer, so on, what was the most effective, looking back? I'm thinking in terms of the Aldus lamp you would only use, at night or something like that?
Yes. I think the safest one was the telephone, yeah. But because the wirelesses wouldn't always work. Mind you, I think the wireless was good. I was on Borden Fell with the wireless in the back of a truck, and I picked up Reuter, and he was telling me that the Russians had bombed Helsinki. So that will date the time that I was on Borden Fell. And Reuter was beautiful sending with the buzzer.
And the particular wireless model, what was it?
Oh, I have no idea, no.
But they acquired numbers, didn't they? Yes. 18 sets and sets and so
but
forth.
But that's the only time I saw wireless, when I was on that course, right? Because by the time I came back, tragedy, our regiment, which was a field artillery regiment, was going into a different division, and they were changing us to an anti-tank regiment. And all my work in signalling was just gone. They didn't need signallers.
So you'd have to retrain them, presumably.
Yes, I just went on guns.
Well, we'll come to that. Can we go back to, now that we've talked about signals and so forth, to the territorial days. Who was commanding the unit?
Colonel Dean.
What was he like?
He was a good man. He'd been in in the First World War. He'd served in India in the Khyber Pass, on the front there, yes. And he had a decoration from the First World War.
Do you remember any of the officers?
Yes. Most of them.
2IC, you know, the second in command?
Yes, there was Major Brodie was second in command.
What was he like as an officer?
He was a good man, yes. Because later on the Japanese called him Major Scorpion. They said he had a sting in his tail.
Well, we'll come to that, obviously, when we get that far. How was the regiment organised? I mean, when you say it was the 2nd 74th Regiment in this drill hall, how was it organised? Yeah.
Well, you had regimental headquarters, right? And then you had two batteries, 294 battery, 295 battery. Each of those batteries was divided up into four troops. A troop, B troop, C troop, D troop, and the others the same, you see, E, F, G, H, right? And each troop had its own four guns, you see. So it came down like that, regiment, battery, troop, guns.
What guns were they?
There were 4 or 5 howitzers, was the only one we could get hold of. You see, and by the time we were going to get guns, they changed us over onto anti-tank.
So that was an old gun, was it? A World War One gun?
Oh yes, one? Yes, yes.
And quite a size, quite a big gun.
Yes. The first time when we got it at Seaburn, right on the seafront there, we were so anxious to hear it fire that we didn't warn the people round about, and lots of the windows were broke.
What rank of officer commanded, you've got the regiment, battery, what rank of officer commanded battery?
A major.
And this would be, which major would command your battery?
Major Martin, originally. And then he got out of the army.
And what was he like as a commanding officer?
He was very good, very efficient, because he was a very good businessman, even a millionaire. He ended up in a millionaire. Because he was a go-getter.
And underneath them you have the troops. What rank would command a troop?
Captain in charge of each troop.
And your particular troop?
I was in B troop, yes. And we had Captain Keyes, and then under Captain Keyes there was a lieutenant. So each troop had a captain and a lieutenant.
And which battery was yours then?
294.
So 294, and you were in B Troop.
Yes.
And the officers of B Troop, what were they like as people?
Captain Keyes, very, very mild-mannered man. He died in prisoner of war camp. And he was a businessman in the town. Very, very sympathetic.
And the lieutenants that you had?
The lieutenant, well, our lieutenant was... I think he was a solicitor in the town.
They were all professional businessmen, weren't they?
Yes. Most of our officers came from either the town hall or from the officers round about.
And below troop, you had your guns, individual guns, the four guns.
Yes.
They would be commanded by what?
A sergeant, a gun sergeant.
How many people crewed a gun?
I don't know. I think there were 6, because I was a signaller, and I was up between the observation post and the gun emplacements, you see. I was in between there.
So as a signaller, as a trained signaller, and in that position, what was the communication system to get to the guns or to the batteries or what have you?
Yes, well... In order for the guns to fix onto a target, you had to have an observation post. So you had to have an officer with a surveyor and with a signaller go forward, pick up a place on a hilltop or in a church tower so that they could spy on the enemy, and we signallers would send messages back to the gun positions.
And that was using, what, the telephone? Or
telephones, yes.
So you had to have your cables run out to the
cables to the run out, yes.
And the gunner, what was the role of the howitzer? What was it expected to do?
The howitzer could fire into the air and drop down.
Very acute and very steep.
Yes.
So it was used against, what, trenches, or what was its original intention to use it?
Anything, really.
And you could get over the
hill. As I say, we only got these, and then we were changed. So we never, ever got a full complement of guns, of artillery guns.
I'm just trying at this moment to get a picture of the original unit.
Yes.
Before we move on to when you changed over, of course. Were there any... do you recall what you were doing, what was happening to you when Chamberlain made that announcement on the Sunday morning?
Yes. On the 26th of August, we went to TA camp at Whitby. And by the 1st of September, we knew for a fact that the war was going to start. And we were brought back from Whitby. For all we'd only been away 6 days instead of 14, we were brought back here. And we were on the garrison field on the Sunday morning when the first air raid siren sounded. And then on the 3rd, of course, war was declared.
What were your feelings then? You know, this is the real thing.
Yeah.
Were you... apprehensive?
Well, definitely. I think everybody was apprehensive, but we'd expected it, you see.
We knew it was coming. Mm-hmm. People in general around you, did they feel that it was going to be a similar war to the First World War?
I don't think they had much idea how it was going to happen, especially with the aircraft. First World War aircraft was just in its infancy.
The signals unit, which I should have asked you about, how was it organised? The actual signals unit that you, or detachment or what it was that you were part of. You would have an officer commanding.
Yes, there was an officer in charge of the signal unit, and then you had a signal sergeant, and each troop had a donar. Supposed to have a motorbike, we never got them. And a bombardier, and so many signals.
And do you remember the name of the officer commanding your signals?
Lieutenant Walsh.
What was he like to get on with?
He was fine. Mm-hmm.
Was he an expert in signals himself?
No.
Didn't seem to happen that you got an officer that was an expert in the in the signals.
In fact, I shouldn't say this. Our major, when I came back from that signals course, he looked at my results and he said, "I should at least make you a sergeant." He says, "But I've got too many bloody sergeants." So, because I came out above the officers, you see.